so nice, so that's what I like. Is that
I say the hip hop, you just don't stop it, and just get ready to jam. The Disco Daddy Wide World of Hip Hop Radio Show. Every Saturday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time, only on 5Live.com, with special guests every week. Don't miss it.
Hello out there, Disco Daddy here, reminding you that every Saturday, 1 p.m. PST Pacific Standard Time, we go live on the air with some of the most iconic, legendary figures in hip-hop, telling the stories of hip-hop, at least their slice of the pie. And welcome to Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip-Hop. Today, we have one of those iconic figures, hailing from the West Coast. He's going to tell his fascinating story, which is a page straight out of West Coast hip-hop history. His name is General Jeff. General Jeff, how you doing today, my brother?
Yo, 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 how's it going, brother Disco Daddy? I'm honored to be here.
I'm fine.
Man, this is beautiful. I'm feeling great. I'm pumped up. Hip-hop is alive and well in 2017. Yes.
And you know that. I'm good, Jeff. Thank you very much, and thank you for doing our show. Now, you have a unique story because you were involved in two or three different entities during the developing years of West Coast hip-hop out here, which we recognize as first generation, anything going from 1970 up to 1983, all first generation historical figures from the time the foundation was being laid, East Coast and West Coast, the same time period applies to first generation. So when you hear the term first generation talking to my audience, that's what we're talking about, people who were around laying the foundation for what later became known as hip-hop, some before the advent of recordings and some after. But 1970 to 83 is roughly all first generation. My man falls straight into that category, and we're going to let him tell his story and mention the entities and how he weaves his way through hip-hop history and now why he's standing here, what he's doing, which is also very interesting. Mr. General Jeff, welcome to Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip-Hop. We just want you to start at the beginning, where you were born, where you were raised, what the flavor was like around you that drew you into this now worldwide genre we call hip-hop. General Jeff, y'all.
Woo, man, thank you for that powerful introduction. You know, this is actually a topic that I've never really, you know, actually gone all the way deep into and laid it all the way out. So it's,
wow,
you know, give
okay.
me a moment to really get my bearings together, because it's a whole lot of decades that then went by.
Exhale, you know, my brother, and relax, and you just tell your story. We're going to be listening. You got a full hour devoted to General Jeff, so you don't have to rush
Woo.
Nothing. You can go into detail. But we want to historically get down to West Coast hip-hop contribution. You're one of the people who have contributed, and you have interesting stories to tell about the you worked with. So you got the floor, my brother.
No, indeed. Thank you for that. And so just know, let me just, you know, be squared up that, you know, an hour may not be enough time, but we're going to go and lay it out, you know what I mean? Because, I mean, if we're going to start with the details, we got to conclude
okay.
with the details, you know what I mean? So
forgive
me, we got to rush at the end to get it all in, fine. But we're going to start off like this. I'm born and raised in the streets of South Central Los Angeles, you know, in the gang capital of America, you know, and we're just going to leave that right there.
Right.
So, but at 5 years old, you know, my mama, rest in peace, she had me tap dancing and acting and doing a whole lot of things in the performing arts. So I was part of Al Gilbert in Beverly Hills, Al Gilbert's Dance and Performing Arts Center. And
wow.
so through that, I was doing a lot of child acting. So I was up for roles. Going against, like, Todd Bridges was, like, my number one nemesis, you know, when it came to, like, Roots and, like, all the stuff that you saw Todd Bridges on. I was, like, that kid that just that made it to the final cut but got faded by Todd Bridges. All right. He was
wow.
– I was a tall kid. And so when he was a little short little – he was the short little cute kid. Oh, look at the cute little – oh,
right,
the
right.
cute little one. We were the cute little ones. And it was like, wow. Oh, man. But anyway, you know, so there was McDonald's commercials. I was, you know, tap dancing and Exorcist 2 and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So entertainment industry, I was exposed to entertainment industry at a young age. You know, got a little older. I remember in elementary school, you know, so locking was the thing. And so we was in the streets locking. We was at school locking. Even in my, you know, when I graduated from elementary school in the early, in the mid-70s, you know, I was locking, you know, that was the thing. It's the pop that you feel.
And I got it. I got to pause you. I got to pause you and interject right here for our audience worldwide. We're worldwide. That locking was a art form developed here on the West Coast, where General Jason resides. So when he tells you that's what was going on, that's basically in the 70s. The predominant form that of dance, and it emanated from the Soul Train and Don Campbell, but it was a predominant form of street dance that was very popular here even before the advent of hip-hop. So go on, Jeff.
Yes, sir. And so even on our graduation from elementary school, we had our graduation ceremonies. Myself and two of my other classmates were like the best dancers in the school. And, you know, the teacher suggests that we put a routine together and we perform this locking style. And we had it like the cold, super cold, the Soul Train, the gear, the outfits, the cold Soul Brother number one outfits. I mean, we would play like with the teacher.
Yes,
and one of the cats, I still talk to him to this day. He said his uncle videotaped that with a 8mm camera. They don't even make those anymore. But he got the footage buried somewhere deep in the garage or storage or somewhere.
You better tell him to find it, Jeff, because they tape degrade.
I've been telling him that for the last ten years. Like, can I get that? And let's transfer it, and I'll pay for it. The digital transfer.
Right.
Like, I need to see that footage because I know I was hot. No. But we was hot, and that's a special moment in time. So then from that, in the late 70s, you know, pop locking came on. So I know I started pop locking in 78 when that was the hot new dance craze. And then that was one of the first ones that was out here in the West Coast that was started pop locking, you know, which also was credited with being started in the West Coast. And so from there, you know, so of course, so fast forward, you know, I go to high school, Crenshaw High School in the hood, and, you know, of course, but by my acting career stopped because I started growing too tall. I'm 6'4", 220. But, you know, so the whole thing was that Hollywood liked the little, short, cute kids, and I was this baby face giant. I just was awkward in terms of what Hollywood was doing, and so then from there out in the streets, I started playing sports, and so then my focus went away from, you know, the acting and went into the to sports, which it became naturally good at. So when I got to the Crenshaw High School, at that time had like the greatest high school basketball program in CIF history, and so folks know I was a state champion on our championship team in my senior year. So I, you know, so I mean, you know, wide a whole variety of skills, but at the same time, when I'm in high school, you know, all these uncle. That's when Uncle Jam's Army, the biggest dance promotion crew of DJs, you know, in the history of hip hop. That's when they were, you know, doing their thing. So I would go to their dances, just, you know, pop locking and just being in the energy, and then talking to flirting with the girls. Of course, that. But anyway.
Did you meet Roger? How did you meet Roger Clayton of Uncle Jam's Army and get into
I used to go to the dances. I'm just out in the crowd. So I would see them on stage as, you know, Mr. Prince, you know, Roger Clayton. I didn't know him personally at that time. And, you know, Egyptian Lover and them, and they was just doing their thing. And so I went from, you know, dancing to the records. And then when I saw Egyptian Lover doing his thing, he motivated me to, like, get on the turntables. Because, you know, he would get on the tables and spin, and he was so unique and special with his skill set that, you know, a lot of people would, like, stop dancing, like, just to watch him DJ. Like, you know, and so it's like, oh, that's, you know, man, he's attention grabbing kind of a technique over here. And so I'm like, well, right. Let me, you know, I want to get on the turntables. And so at the same time, growing up, I was so fascinated with music that when my mom would throw house parties and all her friends and relatives would come over, you know, she had this the old school stereo in the living room with the, you know, the 45s. You would play 45s and 78s and 78s up in
yeah,
there,
brother.
You know. And so that she had like stacks and stacks and stacks of you know, the records piled up. And so
right.
I literally
right.
would, you know, I don't know why, but just as a hobby, I would just literally like just spend hours just like studying and just reading the records and looking at the,
mm-hmm.
just, you know, everyone. So when the part, mom would throw her how get-togethers and house parties, you know, somebody would have, oh, I wish I could hear such and such a record. And it's like, but it's going to take too long to find it. Never mind. But I sure wish I could hear that record. Me, a little boy, oh, I'll find it. I know where it is.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they looking at me like, you know where it is. Like, well, I'll give you a dick. He's like, oh, he don't know. He just, oh, little boy, young, so he just saying. So I'm like 6, 7 years
uh-huh.
old. And, you know, they're like, oh, I'll give you $1 right now if you know where it is. And I run over to the stack in less than 30 seconds, have it queued up. Bam. And they're like,
bam.
Oh, how did you know?
Okay.
Okay. Then it was like, okay, well, I bet you can't find so-and-so and such-and-such. And, man, I was so I started off digging up in the crates at 6 to 7 years old. I didn't know that that's what that was. And so I trust
right.
and believe, and that was my thing. Less than 5, 10 seconds, let me go. I would go right to the stack. Bam. Hey, queue it up. Bam. Stack. Bam.
Right.
And so that was my first foray into DJing. So when I got to
okay.
be a teenager, you know, going to Uncle Jam's Army Dances, I had a couple,
mm-hmm.
we had a couple of buddies in the hood that would DJ house parties, you know, just in our community, in our neighborhood.
Right.
And so I started hanging with those cats because they, you know, I could pop lock. And then when I would get out, that would bring, you know, crowd and it'd be live and festive. And so, but I started wanting to play the records and I don't want to then. Let me get behind the turntables. But, you know, we didn't have the equipment that Uncle Jam's Army had, so we couldn't
right.
even, you know, scratch records. We could just blend, go from, you know, side
right.
to side. We couldn't really
right.
do tricks. So, anyway, and at that time, you know, we had to come with a name. So my name was you know, DJ Jeff. That's all it was. That's all I had. And so that's all was
okay.
necessary. So then going to these
right.
Uncle Jam's parties, then it's like, wait a minute, man, I think I want to get up and join these guys and start DJing for real because I want to do the
uh-huh.
tricks and stuff. But I need access to the turntable, you know, what are techniques 1200s? Oh, okay, that's what we need to get.
Right.
And
right.
that was like the mecca. That was the mecca of DJing, too. So anyway, moving forward from there,
mm-hmm.
you know, so I started working at the Slauson and Western at the DJ booth. That's what the record store was called that Roger Clayton owned. And,
mm-hmm.
and Uncle Jam's Army, you know, had. So if that was the headquarters for Uncle Jam's Army. So through
right.
that, I befriended, you know, Egyptian Lover, befriended, you know, a whole lot of other cats in the Army. And
oh,
so
okay.
from there, there was this big dance in 1984, I believe it was, that was at the Santa Monica Civic Auditorium with Curtis Blow, Houdini, Dr. Jeff
mm-hmm.
and Mr. Hyde, and a whole bunch of other folks. And
mm-hmm.
so I didn't know, but Egyptian Lover wound up producing this record for this new on-air personality at 1580 K-Day, named Russ Parr. So he was the morning show guy that would tell the morning jokes. So in
mm-hmm.
his morning jokes, he would have a bunch of different characters that would come on. He would do, you know, his voice. He'd flip his voice.
I remember
and different
him and J.J. Johnson, the early morning show on K-Day. Yeah.
Indeed.
Go
and
ahead.
So one of his mm-hmm. early, one of his biggest, most popular characters was this cat named Bobby Jimmy. And so it's Bobby Jimmy and the Critters. And so it was so popular that he said, hey, man, I want to do a record. And so he said, so he put the word out in the streets, like, I need somebody to produce a record for me. Who should I get to produce it? And the word came back, you got to go to Uncle Jam's Army. You got to go to Egyptian Lover. And so Egypt produced
wow.
Russ Parr's first record called We Like Ugly Women. And
I didn't
so
know
then
that.
The song blew up.
Okay.
And folks was playing it, and they, you know, let's get him to perform. And so the whole thing was, because it was Bobby Jimmy and the Critters, he needed cats on stage to back him up. So he asked
right.
Egypt, did he know some guys that could, you know, join in? And he was like, oh, we got some guys. And Uncle Jim said, sure, we got some guys. And I wound up being one of those guys that joined
wow.
him. Just to, so So and that was a fluke because there was he handpicked two other guys, and but the whole thing aside from that, we had already, the three of us had decided when we go to this dance at the Santa Monica Civic, we're going to dress alike with our Army fatigues and some other stuff. And so then when I got there, one of the other guys was late getting there. And so it's like, man, we about to perform. And it was like, well, you dress like him, you know, talking to me. He said, well, you get on stage and join us. And it was like, y'all figure out some kind of route, just jump around, just follow my lead. Sure, no problem. Wow. So then just moments before we actually performed, the other guy showed up, and it was like, oh, he's here. So the guy was like, oh, it's cool. So why don't you just be the DJ? So I started off as the DJ for Bobby, Jimmy, and the Critters. And so I would just let the record fly, and that was that. So then as we would go around, one of the guys in the front was like, man, I don't want to be in the front no more. I want to be the DJ. And I was like, great, because I don't want to be the DJ way in the back. I want to be in the front. So we just switched spots, and that's how I became a featured cat in Bobby, Jimmy, and the Critters.
Wow.
And so started from there. So, so at 19, I contracted cancer. I had cancer, Hodgkin's disease, which is cancer in the lymph nodes. So that messed off my athletic career because I was really thinking I was going to go pro. I had to stop performing. I had to do, chemotherapy. And I mean, it was they took surgery. They took my spleen out. It was a life-altering situation. But because my love for hip hop was so true, and it wasn't about getting paid because there wasn't no money in hip hop back then. But I would come out of the chemotherapy treatment, and then I would still, go straight to the stage and go on the road with Bobby Jimmy and the Critics. So finally, it finally got to a point to where it was too much. I left that group, and so then I got well, and then it was like, okay, I want to do my own solo album. Because, at that time, I'm one of the hottest cats in the laboratory. I'm one of the hottest unknown cats. They don't even know. So then what I did was I set up some meetings with some record companies, and I contacted Egyptian Lover and said, Egypt, I want you to hear my demo tape before I go have these meetings next week with these record companies. Egypt was, okay, cool, no problem, blah, blah. Egypt hung up, called me back in exactly 30 minutes and said, listen, General Jeff, I just came out of the studio with my brand new album, and I'm leaving on tour in 2 weeks. He said, I need a keyboard guy. I need a guy to dance and do keyboards. That's what you do. Will you come out on the road with me in 2 weeks? And he said, I know you're about to do your own thing, but I'm short one guy. And it was like, man, it's a fork in the road. It's like you do
right.
Thing. And get my thing off or go out on the road with Egypt guaranteed in 2 weeks. And I thought, well, let me put my thing on hold just for a minute at that time, and then I'll go on the road with Egypt. And so let me go to the practices, and that's when Egypt and Lever had that big house in Woodland Hills, and we would go there and rehearse. So in that band, there was, Egypt had two different types of shows. If they wanted to do just a track show where the music would play and we would sing on top, since I was just a good dancer, I would, was one of the four guys dancing him. When he wanted his live band, I was one of the keyboards on the right. It was this young kid on the other side that was the keyboardist on the left. That was Rodney O. And I met Rodney O from being in Egypt's band. And so, when we would rehearse in Woodland Hills, we'd do Egypt stuff, the electronic. So we would take a break. Rodney, was like, yo, man, I fucks with this, but I'm playing. I actually do, I'm into the hardcore hip hop, and I'm like, cool, that's what I'm into too. And so he and I hit it off. And then Rodney was like, I just came out of the studio, and I'm finishing up this brand new track that I'm doing because Egypt had produced a single out on Rodney because Rodney actually was part of a crew. A lot of people don't know that Rodney O and Brother Marquis from the Two Live crew back in, what was it, like 1983, Rodney was, 13, 14 years old, and they did a record as a group called the Caution Crew. And so, Brother Mark, Rodney O also knew Mr. Mick from the Two Live crew. And when a guy left, they wanted Rodney O to take his spot. And he was like, no, let me get my boy Brother Marquis up in that And that's how the Two Live Crew was actually formed. They put a record out on the West Coast, sent it to Miami. Luke heard it. Luke pulled them to Miami and then relaunched the Two Live Crew out of Miami. And they're historically known as a Miami bass sound, the creators of the Miami
bass
sound.
Never knew that.
But they're actually, Two Live Crew is from the West Coast. They're from Cali.
Right.
That's the West Coast.
Okay.
The West Coast took the 808 sound and the electronic up-tempo stuff and went to Miami, and that became the Miami bass sound. So the West Coast, we give birth to more than what we get credit for. So anyway.
General Jeff, dropping bombs on Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip-Hop. Continue, my brother.
Yes, sir. So, so when Rodney Yo played this track for me, it turned out to be Everlasting Bass. Everlasting Bass. And it was like, my God.
Wow.
That was incredible. And so that was going to be a Rodney Yo, just a Rodney Yo solo record. And then Rodney was like, okay, I got these spots where I need a DJ to do some, a little cutting and scratching. And so the Captain Uncle Jim's Army. Cats that was in Uncle Jim's Army that was in Egypt's group was like, oh, man, this is a hot new cat that out in the streets of Compton called Joe Cooley. Let's bring him in and get him to do the scratching. And Joe came in and put it down so tough that Rodney rewrote the second verse and talked about how dope Joe Cooley was. And next thing you know, that record came, and it came out Rodney O and featuring, first it came out Rodney O featuring DJ Joe Cooley, and then it morphed into Rodney O and DJ Joe Cooley. So when they would actually open up for Egypt, when Egypt would have shows, to get Rodney up to introduce Rodney O's record, they were like, we need a hype man to go hype up the crowd, dude. So Rodney O asked me to be the hype man. So I would go out there, hype up the crowd, bring Joe Cooley on. He would do his incredible Joe Cooley scratches. And then we bring on Rodney O, and then Rodney O would come on with the songs. And then we kept doing it. So then when Everlasting Bass blew up, then it got to the point where Rodney O started having shows separate from Egypt. And Rodney was like, yo, man, we still need you as our hype man to come on over here and do what we do. And then I had to pick and choose, am I going to still be with Egypt or am I still going to be with Rodney? So there were times when I'm doing shows, I'll have my leather joint, my pants on with Egypt, and I have to run back and put my B-boy sweatsuit, my Puma sweatsuit on and run back and right back with Rodney O and vice versa. And then the Everlasting Bass blew up. It's a West Coast classic. And then I had to pick and choose, and I rolled with Rodney O and Joe Cooley instead of Egypt. And that's how I ended up over there. So I went from Uncle Jim's Army, I went to Bobby, Jimmy, and the Critters, then with Egyptian Lover, and then Rodney O and Joe Cooley. And so
What span of years was this that this
Uncle Jim's Army was like 82, 82, 83, 84.
Uh-huh.
Bobby Jimmy was 84, 85, 86. Egypt was 85, 86. And then Rodney O and Joe Cooley was 86 on the way till 92.
Man.
So I did two albums with Bobby Jimmy and the Critters where I'm literally on the album cover, literally writing the songs, producing, all that kind of stuff. And then I did three albums with Rodney O and Joe Cooley.
Okay. What happened to Russ Park? I know he's still around, but have you been in contact with Russ Park?
He moved, went back east and was doing an on-air radio show in Washington, D.C., and then he started producing some stuff, some television stuff for TV1, and that's the last I know. He's still around. I know last year we had Uncle Jim's Army reunion at the sports arena before they tore it down, and he was there earlier, but by the time I got there, he had just left with Greg Mack, so we had just missed him. But, we'll link up soon, but I know he's still around doing his thing. So now with Rodney O and Joe Cooley, I did three albums, the Me and Joe album. And so when I got with Rodney O and Joe Cooley, understand, it was as an official group member, I wasn't just a hype man. I came on as the producer. You know, Rodney would produce joints. Me and Rodney were producing, and then we would bring Joe Cooley into the studio to do the cut.
Right.
And so it's me and Rodney putting all that stuff. And so, you know, we started, when we actually formed a group, it was three of us, you know, it was all three, you know, so, but my whole thing was because Rodney and Joe were the, you know, you put out Everlasting Bass, Rodney said, okay, well, we just going to add your name to, you know, the line of Rodney O, Joe Cooley, and General Jeff. And I said, man, that sounds like a law firm. That don't sound like no hip hop group. It's too many names. If somebody else comes, then it's going to be four names and then five names. No. Let's just leave it at two names and three guys. And so
do you regret that now?
No, because that was my strategy. Because at that time, I was like, the maximum lifespan of a rapper and hit anybody in hip hop is 3 years.
Right.
So if I burn my name out now, and I ain't even went solo, because I still got, you know, I still got my solo career. I don't want to burn my name out even before I get started, because then I'm gonna have to change my name up. And I like the way you know, General Jeff flows. That's a cool name.
Right.
So anyway, so I'm like, no. And then plus two, a marketing strategy I put on right. Let's have two names but have three guys, and then folks got to figure out who's who and what's what. And if we blow up, folks going to know the individuals. Like when you say public enemy, you know public enemy is public, but you know the difference between Flavor Flav, Chuck D, Terminator X, Professor Griff. So you know the individuals. So I'm not worried about the name all over the marquee. Because if we do what we're supposed to do, folks is going to know, find me and know who I am. So I'm not worried about that. Let's run with the two-name joint, Rodney Owen, Joe Cooley. And so that was my choice. A lot of people think, like, oh, that's messed up how they did you. Like, that was my choice. And so, and so then we did the Me and Joe album. Then a lot of people don't understand that the second album we did was called Three the Hard Way. And then why would we talk about three dudes if it's only two dudes in the group?
Only
a lot
two.
Of people totally missed that one. And we was on Atlantic Records because we were so hot. The Me and Joe album blew up so fast, burning up the charts on Egyptian Empire Records on the independent label that Atlantic Records threw us a truck. So they backed up the truck and said, oh, we need y'all over here on Atlantic Records. We went over there. And then we fell, you know, prey. That was when the hip-hop was making the transition from the streets to, you know, that was when the major labels started buying up, you know, all the hot action and the hot labels, and they started putting their tried and true formulas, music industry formulas, and attaching them on hip-hop, and then they stunted our growth, and they complained. Then sampling, you know, the sampling laws came in, so we couldn't just dig in the crates and just grab or snatch somebody's breakbeat and just get it in. We had to literally, you know, pay to clear and license the sample or play live. Interpolations, what they called it, of the other music, and it's like, hold on, so hip-hop went kind of whack for me because there's a transition period, so our music didn't go good there, and so then finally, and then with the major label, you know, just, you know, doing whatever they wanted to do and just totally don't know nothing about hip-hop, and it's like, no. Damn, you know, we were excited, like, oh, we on the major label now, oh, yet they don't know what they're doing, so that was that was actually a step backwards for us. So then from there,
did you ever have any association with Mercola Records, which merged around that time? Have you having major label problems
Mercola
with
Records,
any thought?
Yeah, everything I'm talking about came through Mercola, going from Egyptian Lover to Bobby Jimmy and the Critters, you know, the Egypt, you know, Rodney and just all those records came out through Mercola. When Two Live Crew came out on the West Coast, that was through Mercola. I don't you know, at that time, I don't know who didn't come through Mercola. If you didn't go through Mercola, so then naturally when Eazy-E and, you know, because, you know, all them cats started, because of course they followed our lead and went through Mercola because that's all we knew.
Okay.
You know, we knew then later on it was all Rainbow Records in Santa Monica, but everybody went through Mercola in Hollywood.
Okay.
That was it.
Right.
So all these records I'm talking about, my whole career is, you know, has been Mercola, except for Atlantic Records. And then after Atlantic Records, we asked, oh no, we got to please release us. We begged for Atlantic Records to release us. and then also too, Atlantic Records was based in New York, and they was showing all that favoritism to the East Coast hip hop acts. And it's like, man, our numbers. We're outselling them easily, and we're not even getting the appropriate push and label support from the major labels. They're being loyal to these so-called big-name East Coast cats.
Yeah.
They're not moving units.
We moving right. units, and when on the West Coast, on the strength of what we doing, and we can't get no love. And so it's like, no, you know what? No, 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 we out. So then we came on our third album, the Get Ready to Roll album, and we shopped that around. We shopped that with Luke. We shopped the Hammer. It blew up. You know, we had some tracks for Hammer. You know, we had a whole bunch of other stuff. We had a whole huge thing. We finna L.A. and Oakland. We finna do some things. Because before Hammer blew up, he was an opening act for us with when I was with Rodney and Joe a lot.
So, wow. You know, it was MC Hammer like, opened up for Rodney O and Joe Cooley before he blew up.
Yeah. Yeah, man, he had way back. He had his 12. He was on 12 inches. Ring them, ding, 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 ding. Ring them. Oh, it was. Yeah, it was hard. I used to like that joint.
Wow.
Anyway, so because me and Hammer knew each other from you know the dance circles because you know we wasn't hip hopping. You know, we in the
right.
There was a big club back in the days called Paradise 24 out here in L.A. in Hollywood. Hammer would come, his crew would come through. You know, and have his little 12 inches selling out the trunk. And just come in, and they would just turn out the dance floor. And they'd be like, who is these cats?
Wow.
Oh, we from Oaktown. Oaktown. Oh, that's MC Hammer. And they come in doing, looking strong and hard. It's like, I like how these cats get down. You know, we don't really, I don't know about all that outsiders coming in trying to take over stuff, but they had a certain style. And it was like, and then they saw him, because like, man, there's something about this dude. And then later on, you know, he wound up opening up for us a lot of times, you know, Too Short, a lot of man. We was just on this hip hop circuit. It was just a certain group of us, and then like of course them cats blew all the way up, and then you know then N.W.A. blew all the way up, and then Gangsta Rap came in. We were doing like street records or party records. We wasn't on no gang banging records, and so when Gangsta Rap came in, N.W.A. like drowned out everybody, and then everything that Gangsta Rap thing came in, and that's when it was like okay, there's a different energy. And my whole thing is, I can do that because I'm the dope lyricist, but I'm not finna be on record disrespecting women, and you know talking about all this street stuff and shooting and drive by and glorifying.
Yeah.
I'm not finna do that. So my whole thing was let me talk about the streets in a way that. You know, it's respected in the streets and what's going on, but it's more to life what's going on in the streets other than just drive-by shootings and all that.
Yeah.
I'm still on the parties and you know, have, you know, the cars and gear and females, and I'm on you know what's going on in the streets. And so it was a challenge for me lyrically to, you know, stay true to what I'm talking about when gangster rap just came in and dominated and just drowned everything else out. And so that's
let's push
my solo album back because I couldn't cut through, you know, the strip of gangster rap.
Okay, let me ask you. I wanted that sort of illuminates what I'm about to ask you. What effect on sales did this new wave of rap have as far as, like you said, you had numbers. Up until this point, you had numbers for everything that you guys was putting out there. Then gangster rap comes in. What effect did this have on subsequent sales of the type of stuff that you guys have produced?
Well, that's a very, very good question. Thank you for that. You know, I got to add one more component to that, is that by this time, you know, well, let me go back to when we were moving units. And back in the early days, we was selling out the trunk. We was all on independent labels, which meaning we was on black-owned labels. McCola was just pressing up our records. When I was with Bobby and Jimmy and the Critters, we, you know, it would start off as Russ Parr's label, and then McCola wound up signing us to a record deal, but it was through an independent. But everything else, everybody else was just selling out the trunk, their own label, and getting it off. So, you know, we were selling big numbers for just independent records. So now, you know, the cream rise to the top, and, you know, some cats had big hits and some others had okay hits. And then when the major labels came in, and like I said earlier, when they started buying up the, picking up the independent acts and independent labels, so they got to, they went across the whole nation and just picked out who was hot, who, and just let's scoop them up. So once they did that, they controlled the top of part of hip hop. And so then from there, they put their money machines and their energy and what they always do behind, like what they would do for R&B, pop, and disco, they put that into hip-hop, and then the numbers escalated significantly because now, that you know, hip-hop is all over the radio, and, you know, it was easier to move even more numbers because you're appealing to even a bigger amount of people. And so when gangster rap came through, I mean, if the, you know, the doors were kicked completely wide open, and then there was this new, completely new energy that was hitting these new ears across America and around the world for the first time. So, I mean, the numbers were tremendous compared to ours. So it's impossible for us to be independent and thinking we're going to drown out hip-hop. I mean, gangster rap drowned out everything. East Coast, West Coast, you know, the NWA, you know, then when the controversies, when they came out with the song F the Police and the feds came with the letter like, you know, on behalf of all law enforcement, you know, oh, the feds sent NWA a letter. It's like, hold on.
I remember.
You mean the FBI is listening to hip hop? And at that time, our
special
was like from the hood, like, this is just our thing. Well, you know,
right.
So then when the labels came in, the major labels came in, okay, this is still our thing. They getting on board with our thing. When the feds contacted NWA and said, hold on, we all made a record that caught our attention, it was like caught the FBI's attention.
Yeah.
And so that was huge. And it was like, you know,
yes, it was.
We don't know. I'm not trying to go in that lane. I'm not trying to go in that direction because, you know, ain't no telling what that's going to go all off into. So. I'm from the streets, but I wasn't no community activist at that time.
Right.
Like, no, y'all can have that lane. And so from there, so then I wound up, it got to the point where, you know, we had peaked our three albums with Rodney O and Joe Cooley, and then I left in 92, and I'm like, okay, I'm taking a break. And so our you know, the studio that we made all our hits out of was called Skip Sailor Studios in Hollywood, Skip Sailor Studios.
Okay.
And so... you know, an
Hitman
lover,
Hitman.
You know, Egypt's, huh?
You said, did you say Hitman Recording Studios?
Skip Sailor.
Oh, Skip Sailor. Okay, right on.
In Hollywood.
Okay,
and so
that's
called Skip Sailor. So man, Skippy. And so Egypt found that studio, and Egypt fell in love with that studio because they had two studios, the Room A and Room B. And Room B, they had a Neve. This way before SSA, I'm getting on the technical side for those hip hop cats that know technical side. When you go in the studio, and everything is digital. This is now we talking about before digital was born. We talking about when everything was 100%
still
analog.
Has a
digital
studio.
Wasn't even born.
Still has a studio, right.
And so
right.
You know, back then, Egypt fell in love with Studio B because they had a one of Prince's old boards, Neve, that he recorded like Sexy Dancer and DMSR and a lot of his hits on in his room. And so they can, and that's what we did, Everlasting Bass, This Is For The Homies, and I mean, a whole of, man, that, oh, that need, that something about certain mixing boards that had just good energy and just is just put together really well. And for some reason, good music just always, it just comes out of that really, really well. And that mixing board was just incredible. It produced a whole lot of hits. Everything we did came out of that was had a great warm sound. It's that analog warmth where the 808 bass would just hum all day, and it just captivated the world. And so Egypt fell in love with that studio, and so, you know, that became our home studio. So from 92 to, you know, like 95, every time if I'm, you know, not doing nothing, if I don't have to do nothing to do, I'll just pass by and stop through a Skip Sailor, just stick my head in the door, say hey, you know, kind of be connected to the industry and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
And because through after us, like, you know, one of the younger cats that it got put on, DJ Quick, started recording out of that same studio. And because he was like, man, I would look on y'all records and be like, man, I want to be like these guys one day. We put our studio, Skip Sailor Studio, recording that Skip Sailor Studio on the back of our records. So he started going there. So one day I'm in there, I'm just in one of the lounge, and I'm just, you know, I ordered some food, you know, they delivered, and I'm just eating lunch, just kicking back. And then somebody stuck their head in the door and said, hey, man, somebody told me General Jeff was in here. And I'm like, who the hell? Yeah. Hey, you know, so the light was shot. I couldn't see. Yeah, somebody just they opened the door. Hey, like, yeah, okay, hey, man, how you doing? Good to meet you. Hey, yeah, how you doing? Come on, who is that? And it's like, hey, my name is DJ Quick. It's like, what? So, DJ Quick? Like, oh, what do you need to say? Hey,
wow.
He's like, man, he's coming to me. He's like, man, I grew up on your records. Man, you and Ronnie, I'm such a fan. I'm honored. He said, hey, man, listen, if you got a chance, I'm back here in Studio B. Can you come? I'm working on my new album. Can you come listen to it and tell me what you think? And so the next thing I know, like, sure, let me finish eating, and I, you know, yeah, youngster, all right. And so then, you know, I finished eating. I go back there, and I said, so I had to tell them. I said, look, you know, I keep it 100. I'm not going to tell you what you want to hear, but if I like it, I'm going to tell you I like it. If it's whack, I'm going to tell you to your face it's whack. Don't take it personal. If you don't, if you've got sensitive feelings, I need you to understand that don't play nothing for me then, because I'm not no yes man. I'm not going to, oh, it's the greatest record ever. If it's the wackest record ever, because you still got time to go in the studio and fix and make it better and get it right. He said, that's exactly what I need. Oh, my God. Wow. Oh, my God. Please come hear my stuff. And that was his Safe and Sound, and that was Quick's third album. And so he was telling me how important this album was, because his first record, you know, blew up. Quick is a name, kaboom, with, you know, Tonight and Born and Raised in Compton and all this hits he had over there. And then with what he did for Second to None, and then AMG, Bitch Better Have My Money, and all. I mean, man, they was hot, high speed. I mean, they whole camp was vicious. They came out in 91, kaboom. Quick's second album was Way Too Funky. And the first single was, you know, Just Like Compton, and it was lukewarm compared to the first one. So this third one was the label, Profile Records, the same label that Run DMC and Rob Bass was on. They was like, okay, this is your make it or break it album. Your first one was massive. The second one was and they didn't want to call it a flop, but I mean, it was okay, but it wasn't that super smash. So they're like, so this third one is going to make or break your career. Either you come on with another smash, because if you come out with a flop or something that's lukewarm, you know, you just, it was just a fluke. At first, there was a lot of pressure on this third album. He's almost done. He played it for me, and I'm not trying to say I'm all that. But okay, yeah, I'm going to say I'm all that. I'm the greatest sounding board in the history of West Coast hip-hop music.
Okay.
Because you play a record for me, I'm going to break it down from your hi-hats is too loud, your background vocals is not balanced, your strings need to be brought up, you need to rearrange. Oh, man, I went in on his whole entire album. He took notes.
Wow.
The engineer was right there, and he basically scrapped that whole album, kept one song complete, and two instrumental beats. You know, rewrote those two songs and scrapped everything else and started over. And that became the new Safe and Sound that everybody hears to this day. And then Quick kept, you know, from 95 to 2001, there was only 3 days that me and DJ Quick was apart, because we clicked. We was like brothers. We was like twins.
Wow.
And, you know, every time he was in the studio, I was in the studio right there with him. And so, like I say, the sounding board, he, you know, genius, full of tremendous ideas. But he was so much of a genius that sometimes it's hard to kind of, you know, put everything together. And so he runs by, I'm right there, and it's like, oh, we're freaking packed. No, not this one. The other, yeah, there it is. Oh, you know, that kind of thing. So then Sugar Free.
Right.
So I did three albums with Quick. So it was the Safe and Sound album, the Balance and Absence album, and the Rhythmalism album. And so then there was the Sugar Free album, you know, Mossberg, rest in peace, you know, the Tony records, Let's Get Down, Shaq with, you know, I like playing on the west side, even though I've been playing on the east side, the
it
was so many, man, we was on such a roll over there, and, you know, man, that was a great run. And so then finally after that, my consciousness kicked in. It was like, I think I want to get out of that and go, you know, I don't know, I want to give back to my homies in my hood and help my neighborhood.
Let's pause for right there. Now, what year is this that you're making this decision? What is the final artistic thing that you did before you started doing the soul searching thing?
Well, you know,
was there something that also initially sparked that? I mean, you make it sound almost like, well, I just decided to do this. But there must have been something that sparked a transition for you wanting to get back.
It really wasn't. I remember growing up, I used to hear this phrase that was, you know, they called divine intervention. Okay, whether the heavens tapped me on my shoulder and said, you know, go have you some fun and get out your system, because after this, you know, you got work to do. And it was like, that's what I'm. So in 2001, you know, I walked away from Quick's camp in the middle of the night, and you know, went back to the hood and was like, I'm back. I have no, you know, but I just, you know, whatever. I don't know what I'm doing. Just trying to figure out, play some ball with the fella, you know, just whatever, to get reconnected to the tempo of the street.
Were you disillusioned with the music industry? Did you become disillusioned with the industry? I mean, I'm just trying to dig and see what, there was no spark. You just, or were you tired of making music? Or, I mean, what, there was no, nothing that just made you make a decision, because we're going to get into what you do now. But I'm just saying, 2001, nothing pivotal happened. You just walked away.
Yeah, no, I did. You know, I got tired of, you know, sleeping, moving, living out of a suitcase. You know,
okay.
Moving around,
okay.
Bathroom, you know. So then at that time, yeah. I was sleeping on, you know, like Quick's couch, you know, or,
right.
or on the spare
okay.
bedroom. I'm sleeping, you know, driving his cars
okay.
and doing whatever, because I'm with him all day, every day. So
right.
when he buys
okay.
a brand new S500 Benz, I put more mileage. I'm the one that drove it from, he test drove it, but then I drove it home from, you know, he was sitting the passenger side of the back seat and listening to the, turn the music up. He'd listen to the music, you know, don't worry about it. I'll drive wherever we going, whatever we doing,
right, right.
whether it's to the studio, to the house, to the family's house, to the mommy and all the different spots, to the accountant,
right.
to the bank, wherever we do handle the business, whatever,
mm-hmm.
you know, so I, mm-hmm. it was like it was my car. A lot of people, oh, man, I love your new car. Like, it's, no, man, it's yeah, sure, whatever. Yeah, you're humble. We see you driving
yeah.
it everywhere. No, really, it's not
right.
my car. It's either, you know. And so then, but, you know, I just got to the point where it's like, okay, I think I'm ready to, you know, have my own, do my own. It wasn't like, oh, I'm going to do my solo album, the unreleased, because by this time, I probably got 15, 20 unreleased albums, like just written
Man.
Lyrics and everything, just
Man.
Piled up in stores, just
right.
different eras, different energies, different concepts, a couple of them, some super dope guaranteed hit records, and it's like, dang.
Right.
I really need to stop doing what I'm doing to make these super duper hits. And it's like, yeah, I'll get to them. It's all right. We got hits all day long. So anyway, I just, you know, wanted to, I don't know. It just hit me one day. Like, you know, I'm riding around, even with Quick, you know, I've been halfway around the world in my career, you know, Brazil,
yeah.
France, you know, all over the place. And I realized that a lot of homies in the hood, you know, ain't never left the hood, you know, let alone
right.
go to Vegas or left California or left America. And it's like,
okay.
so I need, you know, it just kicked in. I don't know how to explain it. So went back
right.
to the hood. But then the gang banging was still so prominent. Like I said, you know,
mm-hmm.
Los Angeles, the gang bang capital of America, of the world,
right.
actually. And so
right.
by this time, you know, from one thing in the 80s when, you know, the birth of drive-by shootings and all of that, now we're talking about in, you know, the early 2000s, you know, gang banging is alive and well. And
yeah.
it's like I couldn't make any penetration, any traction in terms of bringing enemies, enemy territories, enemy hoods together to sit down, break bread, and, you know, eat, drink, and be merry and find some common
right.
denominators to put all that down and let's build some strong black communities. So throughout all of that, somebody said, hey, man, if you really want to help people, you know, I really feel what you're doing, but I think you might be better off going to, you know, helping them folks in Skid Row. And I'm like, Skid Row? I'm not trying to do all that. I'm trying to help where I'm from. I don't, that's Skid Row. That's
mm-hmm.
for those that don't know, that's the homeless capital of America right here in downtown
yes,
Memphis. But I'm
oh,
like,
man.
I don't know
yes.
nothing. I'm not trying to do all that. I'm trying to help in the hood. I'm from the hood. I'm trying to help
mm-hmm.
the hood. And so then finally I got so frustrated. It's like, man, let me go see what the Skid Row thing is about, because it can't be as bad as this. And I went to Skid Row, and then here we are 11 years later. I'm still in Skid Row doing what I do. So I literally,
okay.
in 2006,
no, we're gonna
reduce
jump.
Myself to a state of homelessness to, you know, blend in with the people, not come in with my cape flying. I'm here to save you. It wasn't that. I'm like, let me just come in. I had a bag. I had two bags. I had a backpack on one shoulder full of clothes, and in my other backpack, I had a suitcase with my drum machine, my MPC.
Did you live down there amongst the people? Did you actually live down
yes,
there amongst
exactly.
the people?
That's what I'm saying. I reduced myself to a state of homelessness.
Wow.
I did it in the hood in South Central LA. I'm staying in abandoned houses, abandoned
mm-hmm.
warehouses, out on the street corners, and I just got, and you know, all of that. So then I finally was like,
uh-huh.
okay, let me just roll into Skid Row. And I walked, I rolled in there. I had $1,000 in my sock. I didn't ever tell
mm-hmm.
nobody, just in case this.
Right.
This experiment failed badly. Let me go get a hotel room, something to eat, a warm meal, and rethink my strategy, you know, but
wow.
so I don't know what I'm doing. I'm just going off, you know, just impulse, which like Quick used to have this line, whichever the wind is blowing, that's the way I'm going. And so that's what it was. So I ended up there, and I was living on the sidewalks, you know, living in the missions, living in SROs, and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And so then finally I started understanding, you know, politics, because my whole thing is in the entertainment industry, you know, it's a whole bunch of wolves and crooks and criminals. And, you know, the number one rule in the entertainment industry is there are no rules. And so whatever, you know, hey, each his own. And the game is set up, you know, to, hey, to go get yours, just whatever.
Right.
And so, you know, knowing how that is, so then when you come into the world of politics, and it's a whole bunch of aggressiveness and you know, what have you. And so it's like, oh, okay, I can handle this really well. And so then, you know, I really, you know, accomplished a lot in a short period of time with extremely limited resources, and that's how I built up and made a name for myself. And then now they call me the mayor of Skid Row. And, you know, in 2010, CNN did a featured interview with that, and they called me the mayor of Skid Row, and that pretty much etched that in stone. And so, you know, we've been, you know, making some tremendous strides, even though there's still a whole lot of need that's happening, but it's the infrastructure in terms of a lot of nonprofit organizations that are poverty pimping that I'm speaking out against. There's, you know, a lot of policies that are coming from the politicians and from law enforcement agencies that are criminalizing homelessness instead of really helping the people. And so I'm outspoken against them. So a lot of people want to say, oh, I want to donate to your cause. Well, no, I don't have a nonprofit. I'm from the streets. I'm just putting in work. I'm not trying to have a nonprofit. I'm outspoken against the nonprofit organization. I'm outspoken against the missions. And well, if the missions weren't there, where would the people do? Well, we just have room for new missions or better missions or better, more successful nonprofits instead of what's here now, because what's here now, they're all poverty pimping. And so a lot of people don't understand my message, or they don't agree with it. Well, I don't care. That's fine. We, you know, Republicans and Democrats don't get along with and understand each other's politics. So I'm perfectly fine with where I'm at. If you're going to understand my truth and understand the truth of the people in the streets, or you going to believe what society and the masses and the mainstream media is trying to, you know, the propaganda that they're pushing. To each his own. I don't care, but I'm gonna keep it real, just like I kept been keeping it real with West Coast hip hop for all my life. That's all I know.
Okay,
what to do
now
I'm still doing that.
Let me say this about General Jeff. He's dropping bombs on Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop. He's now a community activist. If you've been following the show for the past hour, you can see his incredible journey through hip hop. And now he's a community activist, and I can testify that the man is in the thick of whatever's going on that affects the homeless population here in Los Angeles, especially down on Skid Row. He helped set up Skid Row Music Fest, which I participated in back in 2012 with Chuck D and Public Enemy. And I give him credit for making a lot of change, helping to make a lot of changes and put some of the changes in laws that have gone through City Hall here that affect the homeless population. In the few minutes we got left, Jeff, what would you like to actually ultimately see? Because now, just like every place else, Skid Row is being gentrified. The people out in my audience may not understand this, but most big cities have Skid Rows. And imagine a Skid Row where all of a sudden the Skid Row is being, people there are being pushed out to make room for condos and things like that. Can you touch on that a little bit and see what, and tell us what ultimately you would like to see that would address the specific problems that the homeless have here in Los Angeles, specifically in Skid Row where you work at?
See, now that I appreciate all that wonderful introduction, but I'm going to say this. Like, when I started this show, I told y'all I could go for hours and hours. I got more than an hour worth of information. We trying to wind this show down. That's a whole other hour in and of itself, because I'll have to lay down a whole
bunch of backstory.
Do the best you
can, my brother.
There's a whole lot of backstory. There's a whole lot of information that a lot of listeners don't know that I can't just speak to without, I don't want to, you know, like No Child Left Behind. I need the listeners to understand the playing field before I can talk about the plays and
well,
the moves that are being made. You know, that kind
Let's
of thing.
Like
but what I will say is this.
Okay.
Skid Row is that's misinformation that, again, when I talk about the mainstream media propaganda that they're pushing out, Skid Row's not going anywhere. We have affordable housing covenant on the SRO buildings, the low-income housing for homeless folks, the SRO, single-room occupancy. And so because the affordable housing covenants last for up to 55 years. And even then, they can be extended beyond that. So the missions are the cornerstone of the Skid Row community. And then you've got about you know, 20, about 30 SRO housing units, buildings in there that house thousands of residents, and then not to mention, you know, because of the, you know, a lot of the tents and encampments on the sidewalks. So we've got between 10 and 15,000, 10 and 20,000 homeless folks, right, you know, that are considered homeless. Even if you're inside a mission or inside transition, how you still consider homelessness based on HUD rules, the Department of Housing and Urban Development out of Washington, D.C., you still consider homeless.
Right.
And so with that, you know, we're not going anywhere. So what the developers are doing is they're buying everything on the outskirts, all the independent stuff, but they're not pushing us anywhere. If anything, we're holding the line thanks to, you know, leaders like myself. There's other Los Angeles Community Action Network called LA Can. There's other organizations that's holding that line down. But I definitely want to say this. I don't know how much time we got left, that, you know, through my positive efforts in community activism, you know, for Skid Row, that, you know, I connected with City Hall. And so just recently I was able to politic and make the city of Los Angeles, you know, officially recognize Uncle Jam's Army, and they declared October 28th Uncle Jam's Army Day. And so that, you know, that in and of itself was huge, not only for Uncle Jam's Army founder, Roger Clayton, rest in peace, and for the rest of the cats, from Egyptian Lover, Bobcat, you know, all the other cats, all the other folks that was a part of Uncle Jam's Army. You know, we were officially recognized in city council chambers, and every day for the rest of our lives, October 28th in the city of Los Angeles will be known as Uncle Jam's Army Day. That's what General Jeff do when he put politics together. So then from all of that, now I'm getting back into hip-hop, and I want to let folks know, now I'm a member of the L.A. Dream Team. That's an old-school West Coast hip-hop. That's the first group on the West Coast that had a major record deal. And so with MCA Records, and so, you know, Rudy Pardee, rest in peace, died in 1998 from a scuba diving accident. So I'm taking Rudy Pardee's place, and me and Snake's going to be original member of L.A. Dream Team 7. Now, we're getting ready to go out and do some shows and do some new things, so I'm getting back into my West Coast hip-hop roots.
Beautiful. Okay, General Jeff, dropping bombs, and we're proud to have you on our show. Where can people go to keep track of what General Jeff is doing as far as your current career working as an activist? And also, is there a website or anything where they can start following the development of the new L.A. Dream Team project?
Woo, okay, let me see. So General Jeff is on Facebook as General Jeff. You know, Twitter, it's at Skid Row General Jeff, or Instagram, it's at Skid Row General Jeff. You know, I'm also the chair of the Skid Row Neighborhood Council Formation Committee. We're in the process of creating our own government and a government body in Skid Row. So there's a website, SkidRowNeighborhoodCouncil.com. As far as LA Dream Team, you know, bookings, everything goes through original member Snake Puppy. You can email him at snakepup2000@gmail.com, and that automatically comes to both of us. So, you know, those are ways to do it. And I'm bold enough and strong enough to put my cell phone out there. Hit me on my cell. If you're really homeless, you really need some help or need somebody to talk to, hit me on my cell, 323-445-0723. That's a direct line to General Jeff. Now, if you can't find me, something wrong with you. And my personal email is issuesandsolutions@yahoo.com. In September 2007, I started my own activist organization. It's grassroots. Just me. It's issues and solutions. And so our email address is issuesandsolutions@yahoo.com. And been in the business for 11 years now. So that's what we do. You know, nothing to hide, no stones unturned. We do what we can. If we can't do it, we'll point you in the right direction. That's all we got.
Okay.
One man.
The incredible story. Incredible career, incredible story. General Jeff, we want to thank you for your contribution to hip-hop. We want to thank you for your contribution to entertainment, period. The breadth and scope of your career is really astounding for one individual. And now you've reinvented yourself once again, doing work, giving back to the people. You can't finish your life any better than that. God has blessed you. You've defeated cancer. He had plans for you, my brother. And you're carrying them out immeasurably well. So thank you, General Jeff, for doing our show. We want to, any support, Disco Daddy and Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop, Maven Lynn Productions can give you. All you got to do is call us, my brother.
Indeed, indeed. I just want to thank you, Disco Daddy, you know, the preeminent pioneer on the West Coast hip hop first generation. So, you know, I'm honored to be on the show, Disco Daddy's Worldwide Hip Hop. So, you know, whatever I can do to help anytime, brother.
Thank you. You've been listening to Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop. Our guest this week, General Jeff. Stay tuned. Next week, we got another bombshell show for you. Peace.
Peace.
So, wasn't it a great show? Come back next week, every Saturday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Central Time, 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop Show. Man, it's a great one. Epic, epic. See you next week. Bye.